The date is June 14th, 1991, and we're watching Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Azeem to my Robin of Loxley.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart, the Painted Man.
The Painted Man, that would be the perfect time to bust out your best Morgan Freeman impression, though. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't have one, and...
I know.
I don't want to try.
Yeah. So silky smooth. So this week, we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of this movie, which passed just a few days ago from our release here. And so we are looking back at June 1991, when the movies and theaters were City Slickers, What About Bob, Backdraft, Thelma and Louise, and of course, our movie for today, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which earned a staggering $390.5 million on a $48 million budget, making it the second highest grossing movie of 1991 behind Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
Nice. And as always, we will be laying on the spoilers as thick as Christian Slater's terrible British accent. So if you would like the movie to not be spoiled for you, I suggest you hit pause now, go watch it, and then come back, hit play, and hear what we have to say.
The tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "Sometimes the only way to uphold justice is to break the law."
I feel like that is a, that's like true of Robin Hood in general, but I'm not sure that it necessarily captures the essence of this portrayal of Robin Hood.
Yeah. I mean, it's better than just like rob from the rich and give to the poor. That could be a fun tagline, but I mean, we'll get into it, but there is definitely a weird mixture of genres happening in this movie in a way.
Oh yeah.
But first, let's find out a little bit more about this movie by going to Colin for our 60-second synopsis.
All right. I don't know the legalities of what I'm about to do, but I'm going to do it anyways. In a time before movie studios thought to hire dialect coaches, Robin of Loxley returns home to England from the Crusades with his friend Azeem, only to find his father dead, his castle burnt to a crisp, and his family land taken by the evil Sheriff of Nottingham. After being chased into Sherwood Forest, Robin joins forces with Little John and his band of merry men. Together they work to stop the Sheriff from stealing King Richard's throne while he's off fighting in Israel. Will Robin be able to defeat the Sheriff, save Maid Marian, and avenge his father's death? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Oh boy. I don't know the legalities either, but I mean, you were just so into that I think we're just going to have to suffer the consequences if there are any. Cuz like you looked like you rehearsed that one. You timed that one out perfectly. That was beautiful. That brought a tear to my eye, Colin.
Thank you.
So, you know, jumping on the fact that you played that particular song, my memory of this movie is centered a lot around that song. I mean, there was a time...
How can it not be?
Well, exactly. There was a time in junior high that, I know I mentioned this in our Down to Earth episode, but when you would slow dance with the girl you like in junior high dances, you would always hope it was the extended version. But I got into Bryan Adams a little bit at the time. My first real concert was Bryan Adams' Waking Up the Neighbors tour, where this song had just come out. And I really loved this movie as a child. Like, this is one of those ones. This movie is the first sell-through VHS that there was, which, you know, if the term is something that people don't know sell through. That was when they started to make movies affordable for people to buy for their own private collections. So this has a special place in history. And I remember this is one of those ones that I was a member of the Columbia House Record and Tape and Movie Club. And I remember this was one of those ones that it was their featured movie that month and you got it for $12.99 or something like that. Hmm. You know, and so this was probably the first VHS that I ever owned, and I wore that one out. I love this movie. What about you, Colin? What kind of history do you have with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves?
Yeah, so I would say even though I haven't watched this movie in probably like 25 plus years, I watched this movie probably every day for a period of 3 years from the ages of about 5 to 6 years old, because it...
Yeah.
Like you, maybe that's why, but it was one of the first VHS movies that my mom owned. So we didn't have cable at the time, so it made its way into our cycle.
Yeah.
And I remember just loving it.
Yeah.
So much. Like, even having not watched it, it was crazy just how much I remembered. Like, it was one of those movies where it all came flooding back.
All at once. Like, yeah.
All at once, all immediately. And I was just like, man, this movie, it's like, even though I haven't watched it, I was still like, oh, I knew what lines were coming next. I still like, was like, oh, I remember this moment so much. So yeah, I have very fond memories of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And like, I loved Robin Hood growing up. Like, obviously, my introduction to Robin Hood was the Disney movie, but
yeah.
This one was not far after. And, you know, Robin Hood was, I think, the second thing after Peter Pan that I remember dressing up for as Halloween.
Okay.
I remember being so excited getting the action figures that came with this movie.
Yeah.
Because there was one where the Robin Hood action figure had an actual bow and arrow that you could pull and shoot and stuff like that. And
back before safety protocols came in on toys, yeah.
Yeah. So, and yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it more at the end, but I found watching it now, I appreciated this movie in a whole new way.
Now, let me ask you, if you went back-to-back Halloweens as Peter Pan and Robin Hood, how much of the costume was recycled from one year to the next?
So, yeah, I could best describe it like the Peter Pan was the first costume, and it was like a stripped-down version of the Robin Hood. So,
oh, okay.
Actually, I don't think... The Robin Hood was a little lighter green, I remember, mm-hmm. but I basically had the same hat and the same tights that I wore.
Yeah, okay.
But my mom put like a little bit of gold trim on the Robin Hood and stuff and made it look a little bit more of that medieval look.
Okay. Was it inspired by this movie then when she added that trim, do you think?
Yeah, it probably was based more on this movie. Like, I remember that her adding some like gold stuff and like some more like frilly colors to it and that kind of stuff. So it was probably more based on this movie than the...
Yeah, because I remember one of the things that really took me when I first watched this movie was the fact that it was kind of a grittier Robin Hood. It's like when Batman was brought to the screen. He's no longer in tights. Now he's got something that actually looks like it would be reasonable to wear in England where it gets cold. But I also like that you brought up the Disney Robin Hood, because I also remember that vividly, that I was a big watcher of the Disney Robin Hood. But when this one first came out, it was one of those that I was wondering, where's Prince John?
Yeah.
Which one of these characters is supposed to be Sir Hiss? You know, things like that. And I mean, once again, going back to my mind-boggling obsession with redheaded women, I remember the fox from Robin Hood, Maid Marian in that Robin Hood. She was a bit of a weird crush that I had as a child as well. Yeah, that was one of my big takeaways when this movie first came out, was how much it wasn't the cartoon. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, as a junior high kid, it's like, well, this is my Robin Hood now. This is a tights-free, badass Robin Hood.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I often think about, and maybe it's like the child brain, but I did the same thing where I don't even think I realized until watching it this week that Alan Rickman is not Prince John, that he is the sheriff.
Yeah.
And in my child brain, I feel like I equate them. I thought they were the same.
Yeah.
And it was just like almost a continuation, even though one is a fox and one is... And I remember doing the same with like Batman and Spider-Man all the time. Like, my brain never really grasped that these were different iterations. It was just always the story has continued now.
Yeah. So, yeah. Like, yeah. I know that feeling too, because in the cartoon, yeah, Prince John, it's all about him being evil. And the sheriff is just very much a side character. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this one, yeah, he's front and center.
Yeah. Like, I would say I probably thought back then that his cousin, the like growly voice guy, I don't remember his name, I thought that was the sheriff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, let's jump into Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. It's directed by Kevin Reynolds, who has 15 director credits. Waterworld, The Count of Monte Cristo, 187, Tristan and Isolde. It's produced by Richard Barton Lewis, who was a producer on How to Make Love Like an Englishman, August Rush, Outer Limits, Tank Girl, Larger Than Life, and also produced by Penn Densham, who was producer on Harriet, Carrie, the new Carrie, Outer Limits, 2002 Twilight Zone, Houdini, Blown Away, Tank Girl, and also produced by John Watson, who has a credit list that is a mixture of both those other guys. And it's written by John Watson and Penn Densham. What a great writer name. Penn. My name is Penn, and I'm a writer. That's perfect. And they are writers on things like Taking Liberty, The Zoo Gang, A Gnome Named Norm, and the creator of the Magnificent Seven TV series. And so we open this movie on that big, epic Michael Kamen score with tapestries depicting the Crusades. I must say that the hieroglyphs of sorts that are on these tapestries make more sense now to me than they did when I was a 12-year-old kid watching this movie. So we are told that 800 years ago, Richard the Lionheart, King of England, led the Third Crusade to reclaim the Holy Land from the Turks. Most of the young English noblemen who flocked to his banner never returned home. And we cut to Jerusalem, 1194 AD, and a thief getting his hand cut off. Man, like, prison conditions in the 12th century, just they just weren't there, were they?
Yeah, no. I found it odd that they just cut the guy's hand off and just leave it. Like he's going to bleed out. I thought they would cauterize it and stuff.
Well, they heat up the sword so that it instantly cauterizes, I think. Okay. Because when Robin gets up there to get his hand cut off, you see them heating up the sword.
Oh, right, yeah.
But I must say that I am kind of proud of 1991 filmmakers for not going totally racial stereotype when it came to this. Aladdin, which came out a couple years later, had caricatures. It's nice that these guys didn't go for a bunch of like stereotypes, though.
Mm-hmm.
But we get our first look at a heavily bearded Robin of Locksley, played by Kevin Costner, who was in Dances with Wolves, Field of Dreams, The Bodyguard, Waterworld, Man of Steel. I find it interesting to think that both Kevin Costner and Russell Crowe have played Robin Hood, and both of them played Superman's dads in Man of Steel.
Yeah.
Just a fun little connection, I thought.
I bet you one day Henry Cavill plays Robin Hood. He seems like the type.
I liked the Taron Egerton version. Did you watch that one?
I did too. Yeah. I hadn't watched it when it came out, but I saw it was on Netflix, and the little preview that Netflix gives you made it look so cool that I eventually had to watch it, and I was pleasantly surprised by how good it was.
Yeah.
I felt like it was really, it got trashed, I remember, by critics and everybody, really, but I thought it was a decent movie.
Fun action, yeah. I read that for Robin, Mel Gibson was offered the role, but passed because he had just done Hamlet and didn't want to do another period movie. And Cary Elwes was offered as well, but he declined, but would go on to play Robin Hood in Men in Tights 2 years later.
It's kind of funny that Cary Elwes, I mean, it is funny that he did also go on to play Robin Hood, but as my wife and I were watching this, she was like, this movie has real Princess Bride vibes.
Yeah.
And so I was like, yeah, it would have been interesting to see Cary Elwes also play Robin in, I'm not going to say it's a serious movie, but it's definitely more serious, I'm assuming, than Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know one of the lines that I always remember from Robin Hood Men in Tights is that he says, you know what the difference between me and other Robin Hoods is? I can speak with an English accent.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I definitely thought that would hamper the movie more. The atrocious English accents by basically everyone involved who's not English.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it doesn't actually end up taking too much away from the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guards in this prison are really passionate about finding out which of these prisoners stole bread, and Robin is trying to protect his fellow prisoners. You know, I stole the bread. Well, we'll just cut both people's hands off, they say. But I love the line when Robin goes over to get his hand cut off, And he just pushes them away, and he's like, no, he holds his hand there. This is English courage, he says in an American accent. Like, at that point, you should have at least tried to do the British accent for that one line, yeah. Even if it disappears for the rest of it. Like, do the worst British accent, but try to do it in that one moment, Kevin Costner.
I was almost wondering if I could go back and maybe determine, based on his accent, which scenes were filmed first. Because, I mean, he had to have tried at some point. And there's other scenes where he, like, I don't know if there's a scene in the movie where he's fully committed to it.
Yeah.
There's a couple scenes where I'd say he's
halfway committed
to it. So I'm going to guess those were the ones that were shot first.
Yeah. Well, I did read that there was a bunch of friction between Kevin Costner and Kevin Reynolds, the director.
Okay.
And one of them was that Kevin Reynolds didn't want him to do a British accent. Now, he had gone to the trouble of hiring a dialect coach and everything, but Kevin Reynolds said, no, just do your regular accent. So I think maybe Kevin Costner tried to learn to do a British accent and then failed. And then they're like, nope, just do American then. But the other thing that I read, though, is whenever they were really arguing about the direction of a scene, that's when Kevin Costner would amp up the British accent. So anytime he is doing a semi-British accent, it's because that was a day that he was fighting with the director.
That's funny.
From what I read.
I mean, if that's... I don't understand then why they let Christian Slater keep his, like, brutal accent the entire way through.
But in this moment of English courage, he does manage to start an escape plan right at that moment, and he takes out all the guards. And this is where we get the moment of, you can't save those people, Christian, but you can save me, says Azeem. Or more specifically, Azeem Eden Bashir al-Bakir, who is played by Morgan Freeman, who is in Driving Miss Daisy, Lean on Me, Shawshank Redemption, Seven, The Dark Knight Trilogy, and of course, you know, that silky voice that is perfect for any voiceover you want.
Basically.
And he says, set me free, I'll show you the way out. Now, why is Azeem only attached by, like, it looks like he's attached with, like, leather bindings, whereas everyone else is chained to the wall? Like, what makes Azeem special in this situation that...
Maybe it's just, I don't know, systemic racism. They don't want to waste metal on him or something. I don't know. Or maybe it's more that he, because of his, like...
Respect for him being Muslim, maybe?
Yeah, I was going to say, he is Muslim, so he might be, like, technically, like, one of their countrymen-ish.
Ish, yeah. Well, he shows Robin a way out, and they escape the sewers with some other guy whose name I forget. But it doesn't matter. He's dying from an arrow wound anyway. And the important part is who he's the brother of, as he says to Robin, give this ring to my sister Marion, and swear you will protect her, and we get our death rattle, and he's dead. And then Robin says that he's been dreaming of freedom and fresh air for 5 years. 5 years? Was he in that prison for 5 years? Like, the conditions of that prison are so poor, how would he have survived 5 years? He would have been so much more emancipated.
Yeah.
Or emaciated? Wait, what's the word?
Emaciated?
Emaciated, yeah. Well, stupid autocorrect. Yeah, like, he says 5 years. So, was he in the prison for 5 years? Or is there something else that I missed that, you know, he's just kind of been trapped for 5 years or something?
Yeah, I wonder if maybe he... Well... Maybe he's just talking about being at war or whatever, like...
Yeah, maybe.
A slave to the army or something, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, this is where Azeem becomes an integral part of the Robin's life. You have saved my life, Christian. I must stay with you until I save yours. That is my vow. And we cut to Locksley Castle, and we see Robin's father writing to the king to find out the whereabouts of his son. This is played by Brian Blessed, who is Boss Nass in The Phantom Menace.
Hmm.
This role was originally offered to Sean Connery, though, which I found interesting, considering Sean Connery does pop up in the movie. But he said something about he was tired of playing dads at this point in his career. I mean, I guess he would have been fresh off of Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
Yeah.
So he went for the king instead as a extended cameo.
He wanted to play royalty. Real royalty.
Yeah. So Locksley refuses to join this pseudo KKK group headed by Sheriff of Nottingham that has shown up at his front gate.
I don't understand that scene, just because they literally only show up like that one time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that scene so vividly, and not even, like, I mean, I was four, so I'm not sure that I knew what the KKK was. But yeah. Seeing it now, I see it in a whole different light.
Yeah.
But also, I do still think it's odd that that's your introduction to the sheriff, but you never see that aspect of that weird cult group again.
No. No, any other time they're pillaging villages, they're just pillaging villages. They don't use this hooded up scare tactic anywhere else in the movie. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, no.
But the grand wizard of this British KKK is Alan Rickman, who was in Die Hard, Galaxy Quest, Harry Potter. Here's a list for you for other possible sheriffs. Richard E. Grant, Sam Neill, John Finch, Oliver Reed, Sir Michael Gambon, Sir John Hurt, which both in Harry Potter with Rickman as Dumbledore and Ollivander. I thought that was fun. Mm-hmm. Sir Ian McKellen. And Sir Patrick Stewart.
I don't know. I honestly think that Alan Rickman's performance as the sheriff is the greatest villain performance in movies, possibly.
It's a good one, that's for sure.
I can't imagine anyone else doing it except maybe Patrick Stewart.
I'm surprised Anthony Hopkins wasn't on that list. They've got all these sirs on that list.
All the knights.
Yeah. So then we're told 4 months later, and Robin of Loxley is home in England where he kisses the sand. Ugh, man, like, you'd be spitting out sand for weeks. It's like, that would be so salty and so gritty and ugh.
I was thinking about that journey watching that when that scene came up, because that is a long way. Jerusalem to, like, the Cliffs of Dover where they are there, that is a long way. Long trip.
Yeah, and did they do that all in, like, that 14-person boat? Or is that something that came from a ship that was anchored further out in the bay that we didn't see?
Yeah, like
that would have been a long trip in a 14-person boat.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, I feel like a lot of it would be over land.
Yeah.
And then it would just be, the boat might have just been from France to England.
Maybe.
But I don't know, even 4 months of travel seems a little bit, I feel like that's a pretty good pace.
Yeah. Well, we then get, like, this unnamed and unexplained men that were there with them on the boat trying to attack Azeem. I don't understand, like, who are these guys? Like, yeah, and on a boat that small, how did he conspire with them? how did Azeem not hear that they were making this plan when he would have been sitting right there the whole time?
Just, like, Morse code, just tapping on the wood.
Yeah. But with Azeem, no man controls his destiny, especially one that attacks from downwind and stinks of garlic.
Yeah.
So then we get Robin and Azeem kind of wandering to Robin's house. Azeem, what does that mean? Well, it means great one. Did you give the name to yourself? So there's all this playful jabbing. I don't understand what the tone of this movie is actually supposed to be. Like, is it gritty and serious? Or some of these jokes just feel off. Especially with the sheriff.
To me, it starts off seeming like it's going to be kind of serious.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they reach England, it almost becomes this medieval buddy cop movie.
A little bit.
With then, like, a romantic, like, like the romance takes over for a little bit. But I think that might be one of the things that makes it good, is it kind of has it all.
Yeah. So they're talking about women, and Azeem tells him that in his country there are women of such beauty that they possess you just by their looks. Is that why you were sentenced to die, Azeem? A woman? Was she worth it? And he says, worth dying for, which becomes a very important theme throughout this movie. You know, almost important enough to have a whole Bryan Adams song written about it, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is, like, obviously loving this, it is the best slow dance song, junior high slow dance song there is, as Sean mentioned before, but it is funny watching it now as an adult and seeing how much of the dialogue ends up in that song.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really funny.
Yeah. So this is when Azeem decides to start praying, because it's that time of day for him, and they see a kid being chased by some of the sheriff's men, and we find out that this kid has been accused of shooting a deer on the sheriff's land. Well, Robin to the rescue, And he says, this is my land and my tree, which means anything in it belongs to me. This is one of those points where he was doing like a pseudo-British accent. Mm-hmm. Same with the whole, you know, did you give that name yourself? Like he was trying to do a bit of an accent, like this whole bit here. But he has to fight off a bunch of guys while the whole time Azim is praying. I just love the like, Azim, time to redeem your vow, as he's getting his ass handed to him for a second there. But we meet the main bad guy here is Guy of Gisborne, who is the sheriff's cousin, and he's played by Michael Wincott, who was in Strange Days, Alien Resurrection, Three Musketeers, 24, Live Another Day. I remember him best from The Crow, though. No matter what, this guy is always the guy from The Crow. And so we go back to Nottingham Castle with the cousin, who gives the sheriff the bad news, and he says, well, the prodigal son returns. He's a whelp. What's a whelp?
What is a whelp? It's, I feel like it has something to do with like almost like an injured pup.
Okay.
Let me confirm.
Going to dictionary.com. Yeah, because I had the subtitles on where it's spelled W-H-E-L-P, and I'm like, oh, okay, what's that word?
Yeah, whelp is it's a puppy.
Okay. Well, then I really don't understand what he was trying to tell his cousin, but okay. So Robin gets home to his castle, but there's no one there except Duncan, his father's handy servant, comes stumbling in because he's been blinded, and we find out that the father is dead. And, you know, that classic hijink scenario. Duncan is played by Walter Sparrow, who has 151 credits, mostly British stuff I don't recognize. Robin asks, who did this to you? Well, the guy of Gisborne with the sheriff and his witch watching on. The sheriff has declared Locksley lands are forfeit. Now, I realize that I really didn't understand all that sort of stuff with the signing of the lands and everything that was going on. I didn't understand that at all when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm much further ahead now, but there's something about the fact that the sheriff has somehow repossessed these lands or something. I don't quite understand the politics behind this particular move. Or is that just because I'm not living in a monarchy?
Yeah, like, I think the sheriff's whole goal is to basically, like, take the throne and expand his kingdom. So what he's doing is, like, think of, like, did you watch Game of Thrones?
No, I didn't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. That's one I have trouble getting into.
Okay, yeah. So basically it's, like, sometimes it's, like, you have, like, your big kingdom, but surrounding it, you would have, like, these smaller kingdoms. So, like, it's Castle Locksley.
Yeah.
So he would have, like, his own kind of kingdom with land and people who would live on that land that he would kind of have dominion over. But what, like, medieval kings would do is they would go and they would try to expand. It's basically an expansion of territory. So it's sometimes they would get smaller kings to kind of like sign over their land so that maybe they wouldn't be a king anymore. They'd be more of like a warden where they would still have some control over the land, but they would have to then pay a tax to the kingdom proper.
Okay.
Or if they were unwilling to do that, then they would just kill them and take their land.
Huh. Well, I guess I just really am not up on my medieval politics, I guess.
Yeah.
Or I need to watch Game of Thrones. I've watched like half of the first season, and I struggle with that kind of fantasy. Mm-hmm. I like some fantasy stuff, but like Lord of the Rings has never been my thing, and this is very Lord of the Rings to me. You know, it's,
yeah, totally.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's different. I would say I'm the same way when it comes to like space stuff.
Yeah,
like I find space fantasy and like science fiction very difficult to really engage with, but I love medieval fantasy.
Oh, see, yeah, and I'm opposite. The fantasy show that I'm most into when it comes to a series is that Disenchantment on Netflix. Matt Groening cartoon, yeah.
Yeah.
So he buries his dad, and then he swears that he will get revenge for his dad with his own blood. There's got to be an easier way to add blood to the grave than slicing across the palm of your fucking hand. Like, That's a terrible place to choose to make a blood oath, because like every time you open or close your hand, that scab's gonna reopen.
Yeah,
like it's, I don't know, nick your forearm or something.
Yeah, it's not gonna be the quickest healing wound, and in medieval England where shit is dirty and unsanitary,
right?
I'm not sure that Yeah.
I mean, you went to all the trouble of saving your hand earlier in the prison. Don't make that the cause of your gangrene that you're going to be getting from this wound.
Yeah, also, I'm pretty sure he slices his left hand, and that's, like, notoriously the hand that you wipe your ass with.
I'm a right-handed wiper.
That's why you always shake with your right hand.
Oh, I didn't know that was the reason. Maybe I should turn to a left-handed wiper. I just don't have the coordination.
It's different in the days of, like, when we have, like, toilet paper and stuff, but yeah. I remember that was like a thing when I went to India.
Uh-huh.
You always shake with your right hand.
Okay. Yeah, see, for me, my life has changed ever since my trip to Japan because I came home and I installed a bidet.
Oh, nice.
Man, Japanese toilets are the greatest things in the world. But Japan has two extremes. You either have the fancy toilets that have the music playing, water spraying, bidet attachment to them, or you have squatty potties. Mm-hmm. Those are the two extremes in Japan. But yeah, never looked back after my bidet. So we cut to the witch and the sheriff of Nottingham, and she's fortune reading, and we find out that Robin is going to be a problem, and that the painted man, he haunts my dreams, and that we must kill them both. It's kind of embarrassing, or maybe it's woke of me, to realize that I thought he was called the painted man back when I was a kid. Because of his freckles?
Yeah, I thought that too.
I mean, I didn't know Morgan Freeman at the time. Like, this was like my first exposure to Morgan Freeman. But yeah, I thought they had added those freckles almost like it was some sort of Muslim tattoo or something.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought he was referred to as the painted man. I had no idea until this viewing that, oh, they're referring to his skin color.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, well. I guess I was an innocent little kid. So with his dad dead and his home destroyed, Robin, Azim, and the blind Duncan go to see Maid Marian. And Robin is allowed in without his weapons, but the other two are left outside. And their little exchange is fun, where Duncan asks, what manner of name is Azim? Irish? Cornish? And he says, Moorish. There's some sort of feeling of justice having Duncan the racist shut down at this moment by Azim.
Yeah.
And when Robin yells from inside, it's funny to have Duncan at that point, you know, point me in the direction of the fight. But inside, though, we have the moment where they bring out the fake Maid Marian. And I love how he says, the years have been kind, Marian. It's a well-delivered line from Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
He assures her that he's there because he's been sworn to protect her, but someone gets the jump on him. And Marian, quote-unquote Marian, says that, as you can see, we have enough protection, and we get a fight scene, and it turns out to be the real Marian in armor, played by Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who is from The Abyss, Color of Money, Scarface, The Perfect Storm, the Netflix Punisher. It's funny that you brought up Princess Bride earlier. I read that Robin Wright was actually cast in the role of Maid Marian. And she dropped out because she ended up pregnant.
Oh, interesting.
But imagine if Cary Elwes had been cast as Robin Hood and Robin Wright had been cast as Maid Marian. Those Princess Bride vibes would have been all over the board for you.
Yeah.
I also read Elizabeth Hurley, Patsy Kensit, Nicole Kidman, Matilda May, Amanda Pays, Jolie Richardson. I remember her from Ellen's sitcom back in the day. Sophie Marceau and... Ally Sheedy were all possibilities to play Maid Marian. Ally Sheedy, I mean, we critiqued how poor she was as an actress back in our Short Circuit episode. I don't think I could have gotten behind an Ally Sheedy Maid Marian.
See, I was actually going to say that this Maid Marian role is so useless that I could totally see her being okay in it.
Oh... But they try to, like, our introduction to Marian, though, they try to make her, like, this badass bitch.
Yeah.
Right? You know, look at me. I can get into a suit of armor and kick your ass. Like, the only reason he wins is because of fire. He scalds her. That, yeah. He played some dirty fighting there.
And there's something about it that it's almost like a man would have never screamed. like she's, I don't want to say... But she screams like a girl, and then yeah. Just, like, all of a sudden, I almost half wondered if there was a male stuntman in the suit, and then just for that scene, they took her out, and she, because it's, when she first shows up, she seems, like, really, like, I don't know, the choreography, I guess, whatever, just seems really aggressive. yeah. and masculine, and then it just at that moment it's like it just flips on a dime.
Yeah. Well, after this scene, after he like pins her against the wall, we then cut to a scene where they're in the courtyard of the castle, and the scene opens up with Robin giving her the ring from her brother. So you're telling me that they waited until she got completely out of her suit of armor, which, as Chris educated us back in Bill and Ted, was like an hour-long process.
Yeah.
She got dressed in a dress again, which back in medieval times involved corsets and shit, and then waited until they were outside before having this conversation about why he was there.
Yeah.
The timeline feels a little off on
this. It's also... I'm guessing she doesn't know it's Robin. Does she or does she not know it's Robin when he shows up?
I don't think she does until he actually, like, pins her against the wall. Because that's when he flips up her mask and... Or she flips up her mask and he's like, Marion? She goes, Robin, the spoiled brat I once knew or something like that. Like, was that in that part? I don't think she attacked him knowing he was Robin.
Yeah.
But I think the recognition came to her at some point in that scene after she had already been bested.
Yeah, because I was just trying to think it. Like, they clearly have history.
Yeah.
But I also understand, like, he's been gone for a very long time. Like, it's like multiple times somebody tells him, like, you left as a boy and you came back as a man. So I can see, like,
yeah,
there's been some physical growth and changes and that kind of stuff. But I was just kind of watching, like, why is she, like, going so, like, for the death blow?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
For somebody she knows and is clearly friendly with.
Yeah. Well, we also find out in this scene that Marion is the king's cousin, which is one of the only reasons why she still has land while the rest of the country has fallen to shit. And we get, I think this was our first taste of the instrumental Everything I Do swelling in this moment.
Yeah.
And Azim, meanwhile, has been on the lookout and sees the Nottingham soldiers coming with his monocular. I must say that when Robin sees the telescope here for the first time, it is really funny when he's got it up to his eye and he's like holding his sword out to try to fend off the people that he's never seen a telescope. He's never seen a monocular.
It's, well, it almost seems like Azim invents it in that moment.
Yeah, it's kind of like Flick in A Bug's Life.
Yeah, but
when he rolls up the blade of grass and puts the drop of water in there, he invents a telescope for the ants.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen A Bug's Life, but yeah, that scene I also feel that scene went right over my head when I was a kid for sure.
Yeah,
but it seems very kind of that I don't know how to describe it. It seems out of place.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment in the movie, but then there's more scenes similar to it to come that kind of, like, when you put it, everything together as a sum of all its parts, it's fine.
Well, yeah. And I know, if I remember correctly, there's a very similar scene in Dances with Wolves where Kevin Costner's character in that has a telescope and gives it to, like, the chief of the tribe. And he has the same sort of stumbling reaction as soon as he looks through for the first time.
Hmm.
So I guess he just likes having this gag in movies. So, yes, the Nottingham soldiers are coming, and Marion tells Robin, no, go, I'll be okay. But when he tries to be as much of a pain in the ass as Azim is regarding his vow, she screams, stop them! They're stealing my horses! A great way to get rid of him. And we get our horse chase. But as they're escaping from the men, one of the horses is wounded and the other has two people on them. And so they go into the supposedly haunted Sherwood Forest. Better to take our chances with ghosts than become ghosts ourselves. Kevin Costner, I read, broke his nose in this scene.
Oh, really?
When he stops his horse, the horse reared up and its neck smashed into his face. But he carried on without missing a beat.
Interesting.
Kevin Costner, he's a trooper, that one.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, I mean, it's about to come up, but when we get to the river scene and Robin and Little John have their, like, bow staff fight in the river.
Yeah.
When he gets hit in the mouth, that blood looks so real. Mm-hmm. That I was like, I wonder if that was unintentional and they just ran with it.
Yeah. Whoops. So when they get into the forest, Robin points out, there's your ghosts. And they're wind chimes. Those are sticks, not wind chimes.
Yeah.
Like, how would they be making any sounds that seem out of place in a forest? Like, you're going to hear sticks hitting together in the forest anyway.
Yeah.
So, yes, they get to the river, like you were just saying here. I gotta say, Will Scarlet's rope trap relies on someone walking in a very specific part of this river.
Yeah.
Like, is that really the only shallow part to ford this river is right where he was walking?
Yeah, I mean, I was trying to think, like, I wonder if there's something, too, because it's right at the edge.
Yeah.
Like, it's right before the fall, and I was like, maybe there's something. I was trying to think, does that make sense that, like, right before the fall would be, like, I feel like there would be a lot of pressure there.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, the rushing water against you, it would be hard to ford the river there anyway.
Yeah.
So you want to be where it's a little more gentle, a little further up. I don't know. But Will Scarlet is played by Christian Slater, who we talked about in The Wizard. He's in Heathers, Mr. Robot, Broken Arrow. I read that Johnny Depp was offered the role of Will Scarlet before Christian Slater.
He would have been good. He would have been better, I think.
Well, he's got a bit more of a believable British accent, that's for sure.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the pod, but I, like, have a deep, deep love for Christian Slater.
Mm-hmm.
There's just something about him, but... And I remember really... I remember this movie back in the day being a part of that, but watching it now, I was just like, ugh, it's just not your best look.
Yeah. Well, Will sings out, "There was a rich man from Nottingham who tried to cross the river. What a dope, he tripped on a rope! Now look at him shiver!" And, uh-oh, Azeem and Robin are surrounded, and then John Little says that they must pay a tax. And he's played by Nick Brimble, who was in A Knight's Tale, Roger Corman's Frankenstein, where he played the monster. And Robin says, "As you can see, I have nothing, not even a sword. He'll take that gold medallion. That'll feed them for a month." That medallion looks mostly iron, not gold.
Yeah. It doesn't look gold at all.
Okay. I'm just making sure it wasn't, like, the color on my TV or something. Because, it looks like an iron medallion that has, like, gold wrappings where the cross is attached or whatever, but...
It was also giving me heavy Dominic Toretto vibes from Fast and the Furious.
Yes. So, Robin says, "Well, you'll have to fight me for it." And this is when he sees the boy that he saved earlier. I love the line, "That's your father?" But, like, this kid looks more like Will Scarlet than he does Little John.
Yeah.
Like, this kid is almost an exact replica of Will Scarlet in this movie.
Yeah.
So they have their stick fight on the edge of the waterfall, and he asks, "Azeem, any advice? Get up, move faster." And so we've got, you know, someone getting hit in the nuts, because why not? If we're going to have a fun sword fight, we might as well have Robin hit Little John in the nuts. I do love the part where they end up falling into the water and Robin manages to get the upper hand and he's like trying to drown Little John. "Do you yield?" "Yes, I can't bloody swim." "Okay, then put your feet down." You could have crossed the river there.
Yeah.
That's obviously not too deep and the rope wouldn't have gotten you. So with this fight, Robin gets welcomed into the band of merry men, and we make sure that Robin gives them all a little lesson on racism, because they aren't going to give a drink to Azeem. Is this what has become of English manners, that you won't even give my friend a drink? Way to tackle racism, Robin Hood. You give so much more to the poor than just gold. So Robin plants the idea in the head of these merry men of fighting back. You know, he says, "Yes, I was a rich man, but when I killed the sheriff's men, I became an outlaw like you." But Will Scarlet, man, he's seen red, no pun intended, because, like, there's just, he just can't win over Will Scarlet. He's just giving him eye darts the whole time. Will Scarlet really doesn't like Robin Hood. And I don't know if the payoff when we find out later that they're brothers is enough to, like, justify why he's just such a bastard to him for so much of this movie.
Yeah, like, we'll talk about it later, I guess.
So Robin goes to find Maid Marian at church, at Sunday Mass, and he finds out from her that there's a price on his head of 100 gold pieces. And Robin is like, "That's it? Is that all?" He wants a bigger bounty on his head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a moment here when he's, like, pretending to be the blind man. When he comes up to her in the first place, and he's like, "Alms for the poor, madam." It's the only time that he does a somewhat believable accent in this movie. Or at least up to this point, is when he's playing this blind man. Because he does it later, too, when they go to rescue all the people from being hung. He also does it there, where, "Oh, I'm just a blind old man, I'm sorry."
Yeah, and I think... This is a scene that I'll point to for why I thought it was the same as the Disney version, because there is that part in the Disney movie where Robin dresses up as like an old beggar and then wins the arrow shooting contest or whatever.
Well, that's two different things. He's either the blind beggar, or as the arrow shooting contest, he's the stork.
Oh no.
He's dressed up as a stork in that one.
Oh, right. I don't remember what is the he does dress up as an old beggar though at some point.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, a few times. Because there's the one point where he goes to see Friar Tuck dressed as the old blind man, and the sheriff drops in a piece of gold into his cup, but it bounces the only other piece of gold in his cup out,
mm-hmm.
and he catches it. We're talking about the wrong Robin Hood. So so Robin also finds out that the sheriff is building up weapons and armor at his castle. And Marion tells Robin, do something for me. Take a bath. So the sheriff is also at Sunday Mass, so this is a really high-risk situation that Robin is in. He is talking to Maid Marian about how he will hang Robin from his walls by his entrails. He gets so visceral.
Yeah.
But this is the sheriff, like, super hitting on her. This is his romantic talk to her. And he gives her a knife as a present to keep herself safe. And this is when Robin comes face to face with the sheriff and slices his cheek. And we end up getting a chase, but Robin has a daring escape on horses. And I've always loved the line of, Locksley, I'm going to cut out your heart with a spoon. Which, of course, later comes up with his cousin of, why a spoon? Why not a knife or an axe? Because it would hurt more, you idiot. It's dull. So Robin gets back to the forest with some food and a couple of stolen horses, and the merry men are a little upset. Or maybe it's specifically Will again. If you started a war, we're already at war. Are you planning to join us? No, I'm planning to lead you. And the sheriff has now sent his cousin out to find Robin, and they are now ransacking villages looking for him. And the villagers flee to Sherwood Forest. People are pissed off at Robin, especially Will. And this is where Will is about to throw a knife at him, and he gets an arrow through the hand from Robin.
I kind of felt like I would understand why Will would be pissed, but it's also odd that, like, he literally just takes it. Maybe he's in shock.
Yeah.
But I would be screaming, I feel like.
But the other question I have with these villagers fleeing to Sherwood Forest, why was Little John's wife among them? Why wasn't she in the forest with Little John?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, she is kind of like a hands-on, wants to be part of everything woman, but
mm-hmm.
you would think she's pregnant at this time, so...
Yeah, they're separated by choice.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Hmm. But we get a big motivational speech about one free man defending his home is more powerful than 10 hired soldiers. They take our land, by God, we take it back!
There you go.
This leads into our learning to fight and making weapons montage and making homes in the forest. I remember, like you were talking about the Robin Hood toys earlier, I remember that there was a playset that was put out that was this forest, and it was identical to an Ewok playset that I had as a child.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can picture it in my brain basically being like a bunch of kind of like towers with little wood bridges going from tower to tower almost.
Yeah, and there was a net that hung down that you could pull the string and the net would cinch up so that you could catch your people. But I wanted one of these when I came out, and then when I saw the commercial, I realized, wait, that's the Ewok playset, and I have that already. So,
but it's not painted right.
I'm pretty sure it was identical.
Nice.
And we also, in this montage, find out that Robin is so good at archery, he can split an arrow in half. How are they making the swords, though? Like, later on at the sheriff's castle, we see just how much work goes into the blacksmithing. But, like, they're just pumping out these weapons with no problem. Where are they getting all the steel from in the middle of the woods? Where are they, like...
Where do they have a smelting pot?
Yeah, it just...
I was thinking about that. I understand how they could make the bows... I could even understand how they could make the arrows, although I think that it would be more likely they might use, like, rock or stone arrowheads, maybe, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
I did think it was cool, like, they show how they cast the metal arrowheads, even that, but yeah, I feel like to make swords is a pretty big production
mm-hmm.
that I'm not sure I would even want to do in a forest, because I'd feel like you'd also risk massive forest fire, so... I don't know.
But yeah, they're just pumping them out. There's a ton of them.
I almost thought maybe they were stealing them somehow.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, it just... They're arming up an arsenal for themselves. And on the tail end of the montage, we also see the Merry Men have started robbing noblemen. And because it's Robin Hood, we also see them redistributing the treasure to the poor. I like how when we do see the sheriff's men putting up the wanted posters, though, in one of the villages, it's the one that we saw earlier that he punched in the face and bent his nose guard. I love how the nose guard is still bent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All these guys are smelting swords in the forest, and you couldn't even just ding that back into shape.
Yeah. I will say one drawback of this movie is how long it is. I think it's like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember when they get to this scene, like, anytime that you have like a montage where we're building up the army and we're training people and they're getting better, the logical progression is that the movie is probably over now within half an hour to 45 minutes because we're going to war.
Yeah.
But I looked at the time because it was late and I was getting tired, and I realized I was only an hour into this movie, and I was like, holy smokes.
The sheriff, we cut back to him. He wants to raise the bounty, but he's told by one of his advisors it won't help because they love him, sir. That's it. Cancel the kitchen scraps for the orphans, no more merciful beheadings, and call off Christmas.
I love that so much.
The tone really changes here, though, because, like, not only has he just finished saying cancel Christmas, but then there's also the comment about Sherwood Forest being the only road to London, you idiot, and then the statue of the sheriff where someone has drawn a scar on the face and he tries to spit shine it clean with the guy's hat, and then he turns around to the women behind him and says, you, my room, 10:30, you, 10:45. Bring a friend.
I love it. So good.
I did read a lot of this was ad lib by Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
Like, he hated the script.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's what makes it so amazing, because I've never seen Alan Rickman like this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think maybe, like, after this movie, I probably didn't see him again till Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I think that for most people, he's probably etched in their minds as, like,
Hans Gruber.
Yeah, Hans. Yeah. Hans or Professor Snape, which are both very reserved, slow talking. And so to see him as this, like, wild, seems like almost coked up.
Oh, yeah.
Sheriff of Nottingham, yeah. Is like.
Yeah, because yeah. I know even with something like Galaxy Quest, you know, he's the Shakespearean actor in that one. So he doesn't get as clownish as he does in this movie. Like, he's really, like, he's supposed to be such a sinister character, but he's such a clown. He's such an over-the-top villain.
Yeah.
I did also read, like, not only did he hate the script, in fact, he turned the role down twice. Really? Until the filmmakers told him that he could have carte blanche with the character, that he could do whatever he wanted, and that's when he's like, okay, he hired a comedian to help give him some lines to ad lib. Oh yeah, like he punched up the script and they just kind of went with it.
Interesting. And that probably explains the, like, weird tone wise like, the movie doesn't really seem to know what it's going for.
Yeah,
it would have been interesting to see what it would have been like if somebody had played the sheriff to the script with all the lines that were there. It was probably, like, way more serious and way more, like, sinister.
That would be my guess. We cut back to Sherwood Forest, where we see a carefully set up heist. This is the one where it's, how many? 20. The other guy asks, how many? 5. Don't worry, he can't count anyway. Why scare them? But we get to meet Friar Tuck, who is played by Michael McShane, who was in Office Space. Bugs Life. Look at that. I brought up a Bugs Life again.
Oh, there you go.
He played Tuck and Roll, which I find hilarious that he was Tuck. He was also in a sitcom called Brotherly Love, which was starred the Lawrence brothers that I used to watch. And Whose Line Is It Anyway? He was a regular on that. So Friar Tuck and the sheriff's cousin are riding through the forest, and they have all their clever camouflage hidey holes. The horses get awfully close to trampling them in their little hidey holes, though. Like, this seems very dangerous.
Yeah.
This is high stakes robbery.
Yeah, I was thinking about that watching it, too. Like, you're really gambling that you're not just gonna get trampled upon. It's not like you're behind a bush or something like that, or
yeah,
something that's gonna block you from getting stepped on.
Mm-hmm. But I also wonder what kind of adhesive they would have used to stick those leaves to it so that they were still stuck to the, did they sew all those leaves to the top of the fabric?
Yeah. Honey.
There you go. So yes, they've knocked out Friar Tuck, and they hijack the cart and take it back to their hiding spot. And he finds out, oh, this is Robin Hood. I thought you were just common thieves. So Friar Tuck, though, kicks Robin in the face and tries to make a getaway. He's a feisty one, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, there's the part where he's riding backwards, where he's kind of like, ah, see you later, suckers. He's practically flipping them off as he does it. And he gets his head hit by a branch. But the sound the branch makes when it hits him in the back of the head, it's kind of a loud, hollow coconut sound. Mm-hmm. But watching the scene, it's like he gets pushed by the branch. Like, he really does not connect hard with this branch. That it just, the sound does not match up for what happens to him.
Hmm.
And then we get the, do you yield? I'd rather roast in hell. And then tries to bite him. Man, he's a scrappy motherfucker. I'll give him that. And then Friar Tuck becomes a mule for a little bit. Has to pull the cart for them. And then they just accept him into the group. Yeah. They're like, okay, you pulled the cart. Yeah, you're one of us now.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too. They don't really explain why he comes on board.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sheriff's cousin has failed too many times, so the sheriff kills him. Well, at least I didn't use a spoon, he says. Good callback, Alan Rickman. And compliments the steel of this sword. And so now the dim-witted merry men pair up to try to ambush Marion and her handmaiden. And these two women best the guys and insist on being taken to their boss, Robin Hood. And this is where I had to flip my DVD over.
Oh, wow.
That's how old my DVD copy of this movie is that it's one of those two-sided DVDs. And I don't think I've watched this movie since I first bought that DVD. So that would have been like a 1996 DVD that I had. But they walk in on him swimming nude. She says, what are you doing here? And he says, taking a lady's advice. And he tours her around the village. And I noticed at this point that Robin never has a whole lot of arrows in his quiver. He's only ever carrying around like 5 arrows.
Well, the one thing I was going to say, I don't know, maybe this is too much attention to detail, but I noticed that in the swimming scene, he has clear tan lines that I feel like wouldn't be like when he gets dressed, he just puts his pants on. There's no like underwear.
Well, back in the day, maybe. It isn't him swimming, though. That's his stunt double.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because the water was too cold. They were worried about him getting, like, hypothermia or something. So it is his stunt double swimming. And it's like, well, okay. I guess that's what you sign up for when you're a stunt double. But when someone says risk hypothermia, I don't think I want to do that stunt today.
Yeah, no.
So we see the kid practicing his archery skills in this scene as well. And he says, can you do it amidst distraction? And Marion tells him, can you? And this is where she blows in his ear and he almost kills someone by shooting the arrow off to the side. And then he takes her up to his treasure room and kind of humble brags his treasure to her. like, what reaction did he expect from Marion at this moment where she's just kind of like, oh, well, thanks for showing me just how much of a criminal you are.
I did like that she calls him out on that.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like in other movies, he would have been like, look at all my gold. Look at this blood money that we stole and we're going to pass along.
But no, instead he presents it as like an Oscar-worthy speech here where this is blood money, Marion. It's intended to bribe King Richard's enemies to unite against him. So she contributes her dagger to the cause, but Robin pockets it. Like, out of all the things you could have stolen, you stole her knife, the one thing that she could call you out on later when you insisted that this treasure wasn't for you to keep. So,
thank God he did.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
Exactly. So there is a moment here where Friar Tuck is telling a story about beer. In the 1100s, would it have been called beer? Wouldn't it be ale back then?
Yeah.
I think beer is a fairly modern word by comparison, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never heard anybody say, in any medieval movie I've ever watched, I've never heard the word beer. It's always ale.
Yeah. Yeah, ale and mead.
Yeah.
Like those are, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I was trying to think about, I was like, what's the Norse one that people always talk about again? Like,
yeah. You have to have either ale or mead to go with your mutton.
Mm-hmm.
So Marion ends up impressed that this once spoiled rich boy is now living with the salt of the earth. Then we cut to that night where little John's wife is giving birth, but the baby hasn't turned, and prayer is no longer working, so Azeem needs to help. And we get another lesson on racism.
Yeah. to go back, I do think it's interesting that everybody like will marry. They're all up in arms against Robin for being this like rich, posh, like whatever. But the guy has been at war for, I don't know, 5 years at least. I mean, is that true?
He was a soldier.
Like, wasn't that enough? Like that he left to go and like fight. I mean, like we can this debate whether the Crusades was a good war to be a part of, but still, like he left to go serve his country. Like, isn't that a good? Wasn't that a grown up, like admirable thing to do?
Well, and the people that have decided that they have to hide in Sherwood Forest, they would have been supporters of King Richard, I'm sure, because they weren't living in the forest when he was actually in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'd think that he would get a little extra respect, not only for being a soldier, but for being someone that is obviously one of the biggest supporters of King Richard. I don't know. Yeah, it's a flawed motivation, but from them.
Yeah.
So Azim manages to save this birth, save mother and child, and Robin says, "You truly are a great one." And the birth of Little John's son turns into a bit of a party, and Will Scarlet asks Marion if she wants to dance, and shot down! Oh, Robin comes over. This lady is spoken for! Suck on that, Will Scarlet! And Will Scarlet shoots more eye darts at him. But he comes out of the tent where Little John's wife has just given birth, and he's, like, wiping his hands with a rag. And then, like, takes Marion by the hand. It's like, you should have at least run a little water over that. I mean, come on. Like, you've got amniotic fluid all over you, and you're just going to take your lady's hand and join this dance line?
All over his cut vent. Well, I mean, it's probably months. I'm assuming months have passed, but I mean,
well, isn't that where stem cells come from, though, is from amniotic fluid and all that sort of stuff. So maybe this helped heal him.
Yeah, enhanced healing.
So Robin ends up the next morning seeing Marion off out the back door across like some pond or lake to confuse her as to where they are, just in case she wants to like turncoat on him. But it's like, wouldn't she still be able to find the place by coming back across that lake with someone? I don't think it protects your secret is all I'm saying here.
Yeah.
But Robin sends Duncan with her. I love the moment, though, where he tells Marion that Duncan is helpless and that he needs to go with her. And then he goes over to Duncan and he's like, you need to protect her. Like, he gives them both the same story.
Yeah.
And we get a kiss on the cheek and we get swelling everything I do music. And Duncan says, he fancies you, lady. I may be blind, but some things I can still see. Oh, the seeds are planted for Marion. And so we cut back to the sheriff, who is now panicking because all the money he was supposed to pay to his supporters has been stolen. And he's asking the witch whether he's been thwarted. So she performs another one of her little bone, blood thing ceremonies. Why does her spit sizzle on the plate? Was the plate being heated before she picked it up? Because she just dumped stuff off of it. She picked that up off the floor.
I don't know. I also question, like, what type of egg do you have that just spews blood?
Yeah. Well, it must be like a halfway germinated egg or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
They stole this from a bird that had already been sitting on it for a couple of weeks. It's like, okay, there's an embryo in there. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
This whole scene has always given me the heebie-jeebies, though. Like, also when she scratches her nail on the plate, and it's, God, shivers up the spine.
Yeah.
But she informs him he needs hired thugs from the north. Oh no, the Celts! And they managed to get there really fast, even though I read that it would have taken them at least 5 days to make this journey.
Yeah, I've made the trip from London to Edinburgh by bus, and I'm pretty sure it was about like 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah.
So I feel like by foot it would take quite a while.
So Marion, meanwhile, on Robin's request, writes a letter to the king and gives it to the priest, who has a messenger to deliver it. She sends her lady-in-waiting with him, but it turns out to be a double cross because the lady-in-waiting gets taken out and Marion gets abducted by the sheriff's men because the sheriff has found out about this letter, about her attempted saving of this country. And we get the one line that just kind of comes out of nowhere from the one guy of, I've never seen the breast of a noble woman. But during the scene, luckily, Duncan was in hiding, and so he gets on a horse, and tonight I need your eyes, old friend. And he takes the horse, and he's trying to get back to Sherwood Forest, but uh-oh, some of the sheriff's men were left behind to hide, and they follow him into the forest. And so he gets to the forest. Duncan is all, oh, thank God I found you. But what exactly causes Duncan's death here?
Yeah, he doesn't... They made it seem like he got roughed up, but he doesn't really at all. I wasn't sure either.
Yeah, because he was in hiding. I mean, if we go by Oregon Trail rules, then he was obviously moving that horse at a grueling pace, and he, like, died of dysentery or something. But by the rules here, like, it's like, did he die of exposure? But, like, how long was the horse ride? I assume he's there by the morning. Like, isn't this just a few hours later?
Yeah.
He finally succumbed to the injuries on his eyes that got infected. So we get more Will Scarlet sass because the old fool led them straight to us. And we get a big battle, yet in this huge battle, Little John is still using his fucking stick. Like, is it just because he's that much more talented with the stick? Like, that's not going to kill people.
Yeah, it's his signature. He's like Donatello.
Yeah. But everybody starts scattering, and Robin uses the gold to distract the Celts, and Little John's wife Maggie and the baby are trapped, and we get Robin Hood to the rescue on the flaming rope. And I must say, the sound of the entire army shooting off the flaming arrows is so intense.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it's like we go from all those funny things that Alan Rickman was saying earlier, and now we've got like this majorly intense action scene.
Yeah, this scene, I was going to say, this is where like the movie starts to become more action movie from this part onwards to the end.
Yeah. Miriam finds out that her letter was intercepted by the sheriff, and a bunch of Robin Hood's followers have been captured. And he's going to give her these executions as a wedding gift. Oh, he's so sweet. So romantic. Well, just who am I supposed to marry? Well, it turns out that he's insisting that she's going to marry him. Also shows her the quote-unquote gold necklace that Robin managed to drop in the previous scene to prove that he's dead. There is a great moment here from Alan Rickman where he's talking to that little girl. And he says, I had a very sad childhood. I'll tell you about it sometime. I never knew my parents. I'm lucky. I'm sane. And he does this little eye widening thing, which is so great. Back in the forest, Azim and Little John are assessing the damage of their burnt down village. You'd think that there would have been a bigger fire that started. You'd think it wouldn't be just the village that burned down.
Yeah, they're in the middle of the forest. That forest would be burning for weeks.
Yeah, last I checked, yeah, wood is kind of flammable, usually. But they find out that Robin is still alive. And we cut back to the dungeons, where we see all the captured people are being prepared to be hanged, and Will offers to help the sheriff. I'm one of his men. I can get close to him. This is where the whole double agent story comes in. I never actually know which side Will is on. Because they've established for so long that he so hates Robin, but he actually seems like he does end up on Robin's side.
Yeah, it was less... I remember it being, like, more clear that he was a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that he is actually ever a traitor.
You think he's just, this is actually a sneaky, sneaky plan. I'm going to go give them intel.
Yeah.
He's just sparing his own neck. Oh, man. Christian Slater, you silver-tongued devil.
Mm-hmm.
So back in the forest, they're burying the dead. Robin says, my pride brought us to this. And Azim assures him, no, you gave pride to these people. And this is when Will comes stumbling back into the clearing. See, and this is why I get confused, because he says he managed to escape the sheriff. So he's keeping a cover story intact.
Yeah.
But it's only when Little John attacks him and calling him a liar that he says that, no, I bring the message that everyone is being hung tomorrow at noon in the town square. Like, whose side is he actually on?
Hmm.
And then this is also where we find out that his real problem with Robin is the fact that they are half brothers, and apparently Daddy never loved him. So...
Which is, it is funny because that is, I would have never picked this up as a kid, but it's funny how that is foreshadowed, like, way, way, way back at the beginning of this movie when he's talking about, like, his issues with his dad and how after his mom died, his dad took another wife and he hated him for it. And so that's why he left. Like, he went to war to spite his dad, basically.
Uh-huh. Wow. You know, I didn't even pick up on that until just now when you said it.
Yeah. And his, like, him and his dad had a rift because Robin hated his new mother so much that his dad decided to leave her. So, like, Will is actually, like, kind of justified.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Robin hadn't been such a, like, whiny biatch, then, you know, maybe their family, like, could have been all whole as one.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, see, and this is where Will just kind of turns around and, please stay with us and finish what you started. And Robin's response is, I have a brother? And he's just totally accepting. But there's a look on Azeem's face that he looks kind of suspicious. Like, is he?
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell whether it's actually supposed to be read that way, that Azeem doesn't buy it at all.
Yeah.
But we also see that Azeem knows about gunpowder, or black powder as he calls it, and they come up with a rescue plan. Well, we only have 6 men, and this is when Little John's wife comes over. 7! Are you cracked? You'll get hurt. I've had babies. Don't you tell me about getting hurt. So, good on her. This is our strong female character, because Maid Marian, not so much.
Yeah.
And so they go to put their plan in motion. No blades, no bows. Leave your weapons here. That was one of those lines that just absolutely brought back all these flooding moments of nostalgia for me for some reason. Yeah. But it's time for the plan to begin. Robin covers himself in horse shit. I love the moment, though, where we've got Friar Tuck and we've got Azeem all wrapped in gauze, and they're pretending that Azeem is a leper. And they're like, no, you can't put your barrels here. And Friar Tuck goes, oh, is that your finger? I did not get that joke when I was 12, but man.
Yeah.
Oh, it made me laugh out loud this time watching it.
Yeah.
But of course, the plan gets thrown for a loop when Little John's kid sees Will Scarlet in the crowd. And so we're going to string him up with the others. And the plan is about to start, but there aren't enough stools. So Will ends up getting tied to the gunpowder barrel.
That's one of the nastiest scenes I've ever seen. That, like, when the executioner is like, there's always room for one more, and that drop of spit. Like, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but Christian Slater's a good man for, like, taking that.
Yeah. So, I wonder, like, is it normal for the executioner to go for the youngest first? Like, I know most board games I play, it's always start with the youngest player, but that's cold, man.
Yeah.
Like, let's execute the kid first.
I mean, yeah, it definitely sets the tone for what kind of executioner you are. Like,
I suppose
you really want to make a statement and show you're not screwing around.
So Robin shoots at the rope and only partially severs it, and then he licks the feather on his second arrow to get a spin. I love how they show all these trick shots. And I wonder how many of them actually work, like the licking the feather, or the one where he does the split arrow and, like, rips the feather off of one of them so that they go in different directions.
Yeah.
Would any of these actually work, I wonder?
Yeah.
But then they finally decide, well, okay, we're going to start the plan in a different part of the courtyard, and they shoot a flaming arrow at one of the barrels, and fucking boom! They take out one of the other barrels, and both Azeem and Robin use their bows to fight people. These kind of bows, they look so flimsy that I don't feel like it would hurt very much to smack someone in the face with one of these.
Yeah.
They aren't sturdy. Little John tips over the entire gallows, because everyone at this point is getting hung, and yeah, he just he hulks out and just tips over the entire thing. There is a moment in the scene, though, that I love, where Azeem pulls out his giant sword and the guy he walks towards just screams and runs away. None of the other weapons intimidate you until he pulls out his big, like, Arab sword, like sitar or something.
It's called, like, a scimitar.
Scimitar, yeah. At this point, the crowds have mostly scattered, and the sheriff has dragged Marian up to his tower. Even the merry men are about to go away when Azeem gets up there and yells out a big, rousing speech about fighting with Robin Hood. He stands by Robin Hood, and I think we just solved racism, because suddenly everyone is listening to him.
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm not sure that how realistic that would be.
Yeah.
I feel like they would be, it's more likely that they would all point their arrows at him and let loose.
Fuck this guy, I'm out of here, yeah.
Yeah.
And this is where we get the split shot, the old 7-10 split. And Robin and Azeem use a catapult to get over the wall. So we bring it back to the lyrics of Everything I Do because is she worth dying for? Absolutely.
I love it. So good.
Then to keep it as period inaccurate as possible, this is where Will says, fuck me, he cleared it. But really, if that big pile of hay hadn't been on the other side, what would the point of clearing it have been? They would have both broken their legs.
Yeah. It's like they just know there's always a pile of hay on the other side.
Yeah. Well, I did notice that when they were at Marion's house, when they jump off the wall, they do jump into a big pile of hay. So this must be a thing.
Yeah.
But, like, that's a pretty accurate blind shot that they just made.
Yeah.
And I also wonder, why did Robin throw away his bow before he got onto the catapult? Like, Azeem kept his sword. Shouldn't you take a weapon with you?
The logic of throwing it might be like you don't know how you're gonna land, so you don't want to stab yourself or hurt yourself, but I'm not sure. Azeem does keep his sword, but he is also notably like very calm and cool under pressure and like has the reflexes of a cat, so
yeah,
it's unlikely that he was gonna fall on his own sword.
So the stakes of this wedding have gotten really high because the witch is there slapping Marion. That's my wife, you crone. and the witch is sitting there like she's doing her witchcraft. She's ripe. She will bear you a son, but you must take her now. And I will not. For the first time in my life, I want something pure. So while Robin and Azeem are using the statue as a battering ram, we get this really, I don't know, tone-deaf rape scene happening where he can't do it with all that racket going on. And there's just, it feels like it's being played for comedy, right?
Yeah, like the one that I was like, wow, was when they actually show him like jump up and use his own legs to split her legs open.
To pry hers open, like, yeah.
You cannot do that.
No, like this is, this is not the part to be playing for comedy. Like that's where it's just like the tone so often in this movie just goes from one thing to another.
Yeah.
But Robin decides that he's going to find another way in. And this is when the witch comes up behind Azeem. Where did she come from? Like if there's a back entrance to this room, why does Robin end up climbing through the window?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess maybe he's not familiar with the castle.
I suppose. But Azeem kills the witch. And this is when Robin breaks into the room and we've got the standoff between the Sheriff of Nottingham and Robin Hood. The Sheriff is taunting him. Recognize this, he says about the sword. It belonged to your father. Appropriate that I use this to send you to meet him. And then, you know, if I must, I'll take you a piece at a time is Robin's comeback. Or was that him?
No, that was Robin after he clips his hair off.
Right. And then he says, I'll do the only taking today. We cut to Friar Tuck, who takes out the bishop. And he says, here's your 30 pieces of silver to give to the devil on your journey to hell. Man, the friar is feisty. But I didn't realize this, but in the Bible, 30 pieces of silver is what Judas was paid for his betrayal of Jesus.
Yep.
I'm not a scholar of the Bible, but I learned something. The more you know.
The more you know.
So, and I did write down at this moment, once we get back to the fight scene between the Sheriff and Robin, this is where Marion is just the epitome of damsel in distress.
Yeah.
She does nothing to try to assist them in this moment.
I know. And after she was so, like, she comes into the movie, like, so aggressive and feisty and fighting and all this. And then by the end of it, she's just cowering in a corner crying.
Yeah. But the Sheriff has Robin cornered, but he gets distracted long enough for Robin to stab him in the heart with his own knife. And then Robin is making his way over to Marion when the witch pops up. So the door, we find out, is still locked from the outside. How did she get back into the room? Where is this secret trap door that they have for the Sheriff's chambers? But then Azeem manages to like get some sort of superhuman strength in this moment and just fucking kicks the door open that they weren't able to break down with the battering ram statue.
Yeah.
And he throws his sword and gets the witch in the chest. But there's something about the way that the sword is in her chest when she falls over. It makes her dress puff out. It looks really fake.
Hmm.
Like, it's almost like they had a board underneath her dress that the sword was stuck into.
Hmm. I was going to say, one of the funniest things about this scene, to go back to when they're using the battering ram, that I just thought it was, like, I wondered if it was, like, meant to be an outtake that they just kept in the movie, but after the head falls off,
uh-huh,
and Robin jets to go out and try to find another way in, Azeem just picks up the head and starts bashing just the head against the door.
Yeah, just an improvised moment, maybe, yeah. So, Azeem has fulfilled his vow. And Marion is excited because Robin came for her and he's still alive. And he says, "I would die for you." And they kiss. And then we cut to a wedding in the forest with Friar Tuck officiating. And he gets to the "speak now or forever hold your peace." And we get, "Hold it, I speak." And it's King Richard, played by Sean Connery. Not credited in the movie, though, but he got paid $250,000 for 2 days of work.
Wow.
He donated it all to charity. But first of all, I'm surprised that the scene took 2 days of filming.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they couldn't have knocked this one out in one afternoon.
What's my line again?
But it's also like the most shoehorned cameo ever. This whole bit where he shows up and then he stands there like creepily watching them as they do their I do's. Like, it's just... It's just, why are you there? Why does King Richard show up at this point?
Yeah.
But yes, Robin may now kiss the bride. And then, okay, get out of it. You're wasting good celebration time. And the end. And I know I must say that for some reason I've always associated the company Morgan Creek with Morgan Freeman. Anytime since this movie that I see the Morgan Creek logo come up in credits, I always think of Morgan Freeman. Now I know why. It's because of this movie.
Nice.
But that is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Now, Colin, on IMDb, it scored a 6.9 out of 10 and a Metascore of 51. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 51% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 72. But, Colin, those are just numbers. Like using a stone head of the Sheriff of Nottingham to try to knock down a door. Hit us with some reviews!
All right, let's set the mood. From the Rotten Tomatoes reviewing service, Anthony F. says, 2 out of 5 stars, a very boring adventure film, quotes on adventure, especially for a 2-hour and 35-minute movie. Costner somehow made Robin Hood unemotional, vanilla, and as stiff as one of the trees in Nottingham Forest. The sheriff, for some inexplicable reason, keeps making bad jokes and lame puns. I have no idea why Morgan Freeman or his character are in the movie, other than they wanted a token black man in the cast. Will Scarlet is a whiny, sniveling toad of a man. This movie is what the phrase, loosely based on, is meant for. Connie D says, 4.5 out of 5 stars. I loved it. The only problem is my school is doing it, and I am Robin Hood, aka Kevin Costner. That is quite a cool concept, except I have to marry someone. A classmate.
Okay.
Tyler S. says, 2.5 out of 5 stars. What is with this movie? Why is it so weird and dark and violent while at the same time trying to be romantic and heroic and old-school lighthearted family fun? Why is Morgan Freeman some random Muslim guy who is never in any of the Robin Hood stories and is basically more important in the movie than Robin is? Why is Alan Rickman the Sheriff of Nottingham and not Prince John? Why does the Sheriff of Nottingham have a literal witch for a mother? Wait, is she his mother? I don't know! Why does Kevin Costner's British accent keep disappearing and reappearing? Just why? Why? Well, if anything, it has a nice score. P.S. Was it a rule in the 90s that Sean Connery had to appear in every mediocre medieval fantasy movie that came out or something? Matt G. says, 2.5 out of 5 stars. Look, this movie has some fun stuff in it, bouncy score, unique cinematography, great battle scenes, but mostly is just aggressively dumb. Bad accents, awkward humor. However, the main thing I walked away from Prince of Thieves with is a continuation of a question I've had for years. Why was Kevin Costner so popular? Not sure there has ever been an actor in Hollywood history with less charisma to pair with his mediocre acting chops. Steve W., 1 out of 5, says, Robin Hood, Prince of Cheese! For some reason, I've never watched this film. I guess I wasn't really a Kevin Costner fan as a kid. Who is? And I even think back then, I found an American Robin Hood stupid. Alas, however, with an interest in historical adventure, I decided to get around to this. What the actual hell, 1991? This was your second highest grossing film? I was expecting a Hollywood movie, no doubt. I know that entails a certain amount of Americanization and commercialization. It happens in Braveheart, for example, but they still have a foot in some kind of reality, even if they paint characters with broad strokes. But this? Everyone who isn't good is a sniveling pantomime villain. Alan Rickman is like a cinematic version of Blackadder. He is raised by a devil-worshipping witch? What the fluff? Complete with a children's TV dungeon set that has dry ice and green lights. The main problem, aside from the casting of Robin Hood, is this is neither fish nor fowl. If they had intended to make a swashbuckling adventure movie, maybe some of this would be overlooked, but every so often they try and make this some profound historical epic with Kevin spewing out some half-assed noble words. Honestly, the one with the cartoon fox was more believable.
I like that one. That was a good one. Yeah, he had a lot of the same questions that I did. If this guy is listening to this particular podcast, I did read there is a deleted scene where we do find out that the witch is the Sheriff of Nottingham's mother.
Oh, interesting.
That is actually part of the storyline. So, yeah, 6.9 and 72 from the audiences, 51s from the critics. Where does it fall for you?
To be honest, I expected to hate this movie, but the nostalgia factor really kicked in.
Very
so
much.
I think I would just caveat with, I love this movie still, despite the bad act, or not the bad acting necessarily, but definitely the bad accents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty true to Robin Hood. It's more true to Robin Hood to me than the Russell Crowe movie. I remember being disappointed with that one.
Yeah.
I would give it objectively as a movie, probably like a 65 to 70%.
Yeah.
But that doesn't take away from how much I enjoyed watching it this round.
Yeah, you know, I have to say that once again, I mean, we always end up kind of on the same page with these movies, with a few exceptions, but I'm kind of the same, where I can see a mid-60s movie if I were to rate it, but it's the nostalgia kicked in overdrive big time. I am so happy that I revisited this movie.
Yeah.
And I know that even when I went to first put it in, I'm kind of like, am I in the mood for Robin Hood? It's a 2.5 hour movie. Do I have this one in me? But like once I put it in, it just all came flooding back to me. And it's not a great movie. There's questionable acting. There's mismatched tone shifts in this movie.
For sure.
But I still enjoyed my time watching this movie. And yeah, I'm definitely glad that I revisited it.
There you go.
Well, there we go. That is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and that's our show for this week. If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is, well, tell your friends. Word of mouth is so important for a podcast trying to get noticed in the huge sea out there. There's so many podcasts. We're not Conan O'Brien. We didn't come into this with fame. We are the self-proclaimed official rival podcast of Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. So we need every fan that we get, and word of mouth is the best way to do that for us. Or the other way to do it is to go on to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on and give us 5 stars, especially on Apple Podcasts. It doesn't matter what you say. You could say, I'd die for you. That would fit the tone of this episode. But it's those 5 stars that just drive you up the charts, and they help us get noticed.
Okay, one more time for good measure.
We're going to have theme song playing over this moment, you know.
All right. Well, If you want to get in touch with us, the best way to do it is to go to our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all of our social media. We have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have Instagram, as well as links to all our podcast episodes. If you would like to write to us, you can reach us at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Drop us a line and let us know what you think of the show. Let us know what movies you used to like, because, as always, everything we do it for you.
Worth it. And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon community and join the likes of our current executive producer, Joshua Blum. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter in the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.